Hundreds of thousands of Americans go into cardiac arrest each year. Relatively few survive. This hour, making survival a bigger priority. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, we'll hear from an Iowa woman whose children saved her when she went into cardiac arrest at home. Also, a cardiologist on new ways to treat it. Then I'll talk with the father of an Iowa teen who was swept into a storm drain and killed last year. Now the father is campaigning to make storm sewers safer. Also, evidence from an Iowa murder investigation goes to China, and safe driving tips for this 4th of July weekend. First, this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Cardiac arrest strikes almost 600,000 people each year, and it kills the vast majority of those individuals. That's according to a new report from the Institute of Medicine. An estimate suggests that cardiac arrest is the third leading cause of death in the United States, right behind cancer and heart disease. This hour, we want to talk about cardiac arrest and about the latest ways to improve survival when it strikes. Joining us to do that, Dr. Diane Atkins is a pediatric cardiologist at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Atkins, welcome to the program.
Good day. It's nice to be here.
Kathy Jensen is with us as well in our Iowa City studio. Kathy, you are a survivor of cardiac arrest.
Yes, I am.
I want to hear your story in just a moment. But first of all, Dr. Atkins, let's clear up what is often a confusion here. Cardiac arrest is not heart attack. What is the difference?
A cardiac arrest is the immediate electrical abnormality of the control of the heartbeat, such that the heart is unable to pump blood, and the person who experiences it collapses, loses consciousness immediately, and is not treated within seconds to minutes, will die or suffer serious disability. A heart attack is actually a blockage of one of the arteries in the heart so that oxygen is not delivered to the heart muscle.
So the muscle in the heart attack case is still working, still pumping. It's just there's a blockage.
That's correct.
Okay.
And often patients will have pain with a heart attack. With a cardiac arrest, they are immediately unconscious.
Okay, if you'd like to join us this half hour with a question, please do, about cardiac arrest. Perhaps you have some experience with you or your family with cardiac arrest. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Talking about cardiac arrest, half of the program today. Kathy Jensen, let's talk about your survival after a cardiac arrest. It happened in 1999. What was the setting? Your home?
Yes, I was in my home and my family. We were all together in different parts of our house. And I was actually talking on the phone to a teacher friend. We were planning a conference that we were going to be attending the next day. And I just collapsed.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember about that moment? Did you go unconscious? Were you aware of anything when it happened?
I was talking on the phone and just immediately collapsed. So, you know, I think what Dr. Atkins said is pretty important, is that there really are no warning signs and no symptoms that come with a cardiac arrest. So actually, Ben, I can't say to you, this is what I was feeling, or, you know, I had any kind of symptoms ahead of time. I was truly talking on the phone, and I fell to the floor and have no memory of falling to the floor.
What was your first memory after it happened?
Being in the emergency room at the University Hospital here in Iowa City, and my cardiologist had been called, and of course my family were there, and they were talking to me, and I woke up.
And you woke up, and did you say what happened?
Mm-hmm. A lot of times I kept asking the question, where am I? Why am I here? But actually, there was only, for my situation, there was only about 3 hours difference from the time that I collapsed until the time that I woke up. And I don't think that's that usual from what I've, you know, learned and reading and talking to people. That's just not that usual. You know, people do sometimes, they're unconscious and they do seem to be out for longer periods of time.
Statistically speaking, Kathy, you are a lucky one, Dr. Atkins, a lot. How many don't survive? I mean, there's a difference between those who have an arrest in a hospital setting and at a home. What are the statistics there?
The current statistics nationwide are that 6% of people who suffer a cardiac arrest out of the hospital will survive. Now, that probably includes a large number of people who have significant disability related to the cardiac arrest. Within a hospital, the survival is a bit higher, 24%. But there still is the vast majority do not survive the event, and many still have significant functional disability after the event.
Mm-hmm. And when we compare it to heart attacks, the survival rate is better for heart attacks?
The survival rate for heart attacks is immensely better. I don't really have the exact numbers, but over the last 20 years, the research activity in cardiac arrest has really led to remarkable improvements in survival of that.
When a person has a heart attack, we know that it can take many different express itself in many different degrees, depending on where the blockage is. Does a cardiac arrest have an on and off switch type of character, or is it also one that falls in a spectrum?
Cardiac arrest is sudden, abrupt, and everybody will lose consciousness.
Lights out.
Totally. And if they do not get CPR and defibrillation, if that's appropriate, within the first seconds to minutes, they will either die or suffer serious neurologic brain damage.
Mm-hmm. So Kathy's case is an exception. What can you say about her case compared to most?
Well, I should say that Kathy and I are good friends. We've known each other for a long time. Kathy got immediate CPR from her son, who had just had CPR training at City High. And she also had immediate defibrillation by our EMS service when they arrived. So she had the two best instances of therapy outside the hospital that would predict survival.
Mm. I can imagine in the years since that happened, Kathy, you look at your son who is now in his 20s.
Actually, he's 31.
He's 31. Uh-huh. I didn't quite do my math correctly. Yeah. Okay. You must look at him ever since that day in a different way.
Well, he and my daughter also, and my husband, because
we're all in it. As you said,
they were there to play their roles, and the chain of survival took place immediately. When I hit the kitchen floor, my daughter heard me fall, and she was in the basement. And so she ran up the stairs and saw that I was on the floor. And she immediately yelled for her dad and for her brother, and they both came up. And she got on the phone and called 911, and my husband then started CPR. But the interesting thing about that is that we adults sometimes think, unless we've had a course, you know, in CPR, we do think that we probably know how to do it. And Greg had actually never had a course, but he really felt that he knew, you know, how to perform it. So as he was performing CPR immediately, and my daughter was on the phone talking to 911, he was not having much success. He couldn't get a pulse. He couldn't get breath to come into my airway. So really, when my son came up and said, "Dad, you've got to tilt my mom's head back because there's something wrong with her airway. It's blocked." And so really, Chris was instrumental in recognizing that my head needed to be tilted back. And then the CPR was able to be successful. And like Dr. Atkins said, you know, immediate response is very important. And it took 6 minutes from the time my daughter called 911 to the EMS and the firemen getting to my home.
Very quick response. Mm-hmm. Vital in this situation.
Absolutely.
As Dr. Atkins, as you pointed out here. So do we know why you had a cardiac arrest? Is this tied with previous problems?
You know, I think that the jury is probably still out on that, Ben. I am a person that had a heart defect when I was born, and I have had 3 open heart surgeries in my life. But actually, this is, so there, you know, I think the history says that there could have been some position that, yes, you know, perhaps I was an easier candidate for that than others. But I, you know, was feeling fine and was really active. I was doing aerobics. I was teaching school. So the low potassium count that took place when they did take blood after I got to the hospital was really the only signal that they thought, you know, that could have been perhaps causing it.
Kathy Jensen, if you've just joined us, Kathy Jensen is a survivor of cardiac arrest. She's recalling the 1999 incident where her family acted correctly and quickly, together with the rest of her family, her son, who was 12 at the time, performed CPR, having learned CPR only a couple days beforehand. If you have a question about cardiac arrest, 1-866-780-9100. Dr. Atkins, let's talk a little bit more about the nature of cardiac arrest and this new report. To go to the cause here, do we know why some people have cardiac arrest? What leads to it?
The simple answer to that is no. There are some people who have risk factors, but many, many people can have a cardiac arrest and there's no clear explanation for it. It occurs in all ages, all racial groups, both sexes.
More likely when you get older?
Definitely more likely when you get older. And some patients who can experience a cardiac arrest in the setting of a heart attack, but by no means all or even the majority of people are having a heart attack. It's a electrical malfunction of the heart so that the heart is incapable of effectively pumping blood to the body.
More likely to have a cardiac arrest when you're in a stressful situation?
There are certainly many research studies to show that the risk of cardiac arrest does go up. It's been looked at after 9/11, for example, the Japanese earthquake, and over the next several weeks to months. So it's not immediate, but over time, as you have to live through those stressful events, the overall incidence of cardiac arrest does go up.
Let's talk about this report from the Institute of Medicine. What did the report look at?
This is a very comprehensive study of all aspects of cardiac arrest, because what we know is that for the survival statistics to increase, it's a system response. So we started at the very beginning. We went all the way through. We looked at the public health burden, which is obviously huge. We looked at the public engagement. We looked at the function of EMS. We looked at in-hospital settings. And we also looked at where we stand with research activities. And we have made recommendations to the – basically to our country on how we can improve our results.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So your involvement more precisely in this study was?
I was a member of the panel. There were, I believe, 19 of us, all considered experts of some sort of another in this subject. And we've worked together for the last about 18 months, a very thorough review of the literature. The document that we prepared is 400 pages and cites probably well over 1,500 references. So a very, very comprehensive study of our system of response to cardiac arrest and what we need to do to improve our survival statistics. Because one point I want to make is that although nationwide our statistics are very low, there are definitely benchmark communities in the United States who have taken a very serious approach, very thoughtful approach to their cardiac arrest care, and have dramatically better statistics than nationally.
Name a few of those communities.
Seattle King County in the state of Washington is probably the best known. The state of Arizona has also made a very statewide concerted effort. There have been some things in Wisconsin, North Carolina. The in-hospital situation, since that's more broad, we now know that there's a large database, Get With The Guidelines Resuscitation. When hospitals participate in that, just because of the ability to look at their own data, their results improve. So mm-hmm. there are definitely some benchmark communities that we can look at.
None of them with Iowa attached?
Not right now, no.
Okay, we're working on that.
Yes, that okay. will be one of the goals as we move forward with this report.
Okay, if you want to be a community that does a better job of responding to cardiac arrest, what do you need to have? What are the characteristics?
The first thing we need is public engagement so that the public is willing to do CPR. They need to be trained in CPR. The one thing that Iowa does stand out is that we were the first state in the country to require CPR as a graduation requirement from high school. Since that time, 25 states have moved forward with that, but we were the first in 2008. The second thing would be something that's called dispatcher CPR or telephone CPR, so that there is a very specific protocol. When you call 911, the dispatcher can determine with two questions: is the victim conscious? Is the victim breathing normally? If the answer to both of those questions is no, then the dispatcher can provide instructions on how to do CPR to the people who are with the victim. Mm-hmm. EMS, a very organized response in terms of the kinds of first responders and the rapidity of response is important. And then the transitions of care into the hospital with post-cardiac arrest care, that has become very, very important. Obviously, the body has suffered a tremendous insult, and there are many things that happen, and they need to receive appropriate care. And that care is definitely improved, but we know that many, many of the therapies that we are delivering can probably be optimized.
Mm-hmm. More and more facilities, I've noticed, have the, I don't know what you call them, the paddles that shock you.
Yes.
Is that also part of the quick response, or is that more to do with heart attack?
No, that is absolutely the quick response for cardiac arrest, because usually when you have a heart attack, you don't need that shock.
What are those called?
Defibrillators.
That's the word I was looking for.
And what one of the main emphases over the last several years has been public access defibrillation, where these defibrillators that can be used by lay people with actually no or minimal training, they can be applied. They detect automatically whether the patient has a rhythm that needs to be shocked, deliver a very specific instruction, and you can hit the button and the shock is delivered.
Mm-hmm. With so many deaths, almost 600,000 people per year suffering from cardiac arrest, the majority of them dying from it. We hear so much about heart attacks, not that we shouldn't hear about heart attacks, but cardiac arrest is really not receiving the attention, hasn't for years. Why do you think that is?
I think most people think that it's a non-survivable event. Well, you know, that's just what happens, and that's one way to die. The last 30 years, the American Heart Association has had guidelines on the treatment of cardiac arrest. They have been revised on a regular basis. And there has been increasing research to show that obviously it can be a survivable event and that we need to improve our response to it. There is a graph in our report that compares the number of deaths to the number of grants and the number of studies published for cardiac arrest, stroke, and heart disease. And cardiac arrest has minimal research grants and studies compared to those other diseases. But there are more deaths on an annual basis from cardiac arrest than stroke or other forms of heart disease.
Mm-hmm. So if there was a pickup in money, an uptick in the money available, grant money for research, how do you think it would be best spent?
I think we need research from starting with the basic science. What happens to the cells in our body when the body experiences a cardiac arrest? We need studies on new drugs for cardiac arrest, because most of the drugs that we use right now really have not been shown to be effective in the long run. We need increased research on how best to educate our public so that they can do CPR. We need solid data on really what is the incidence. Although we have quoted a figure in our report, that's an estimate. We really honestly don't know. And so our first recommendation is that cardiac arrest become a reportable event and that we have a nationwide database to record cardiac arrest and record other characteristics of each event.
Mm-hmm. Remind us, how long, Kathy, was your heart not beating in 1999 during that arrest?
I imagine probably 6 to 7 minutes.
6 to 7 minutes. Mm-hmm. Is that sort of the, Dr. Atkins, the outer limit of survivability?
What we know is that if you don't get CPR, that your survival decreases by 10% for every minute. So if you don't get CPR at 10 minutes, your chances of survival are virtually zero.
So that CPR, even though her heart did not resume pumping, was helping her?
Absolutely.
How?
Absolutely. It was moving blood through her body so that her brain and her heart and the other organs of her body were still getting oxygen delivered to them. So CPR, if you get immediate bystander CPR, your chances of survival double immediately just from getting chest compressions. In fact, the Heart Association now recommends, especially if you're unwilling to do the ventilation part, the breathing part, just give chest compressions because that starts the recirculation of the blood.
Mm-hmm. With 6 or 7 minutes without a heartbeat, Kathy Jensen, you don't have a near-death experience to recall?
I do, but that's probably another radio show.
You do. So you remember what?
That near-death experience actually came after I'd been in the hospital about 3 days. So I didn't actually...
The recollection of it or the actual experience?
Well, I'm not sure about that, Ben. The recollection came about 3 days after I'd been in the hospital. So I actually don't know. You know,
and what did you remember?
I just had an angel sitting at the foot of my bed telling me that I was going to be okay and that I had to be calm. I had to be calm. I had to be calm. She repeated that 3 times and said that I had to have faith. And I recalled that 3 days later.
It must have been an emotional experience.
It was for my family and for my friends. And yeah, it was.
Okay. We have a minute or so left. Dr. Atkins, mention anything that didn't get mentioned, perhaps also how people can find out more about cardiac arrest and treating it.
I want to emphasize the magnitude of this problem, and I want to emphasize that it requires a system to respond. So at all levels of the care, from bystander to the most complicated ICU care that we can deliver, it needs to be organized, coordinated, and we need to be constantly reevaluating what we are doing with continuous quality improvement. Again, something else that we emphasize in the report.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Talking about a new report out from the Institute of Medicine and Dr. Diane Atkins of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics involved in creating that report. She is a pediatric cardiologist at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Atkins, thank you for coming into our studio today.
Thank you.
And Kathy Jensen, let me say this loudly and clearly, we are glad you are with us today.
Thank you.
So am I.
Thanks to your family and that brilliant, quick reaction that you're still with us. Kathy Jensen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll talk about a few things. We'll talk with the father of an Iowa teen who was swept into a storm drain and killed last year. Now that father is campaigning to make storm sewers safer. Talk with him when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support comes from Legacy.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In just a moment, we'll talk about how safe driving works, especially on this coming weekend, one of the most deadly weekends traditionally in driving around the country. The National Safety Council forecasting over 400 Americans will be killed on the road during this long 4th of July weekend, nearly 50,000 injured, according to that forecast. We'll talk about road safety and also some new technology that is helping us drive more safely in just a few minutes. It's been a year since 17-year-old Logan Blake died. This was after he was swept into a storm sewer in Cedar Rapids. And it's an incident that spurred his father, Mark, to start Project Storm Drain Safety. It aims to cover storm sewers in Cedar Rapids and all over the country with grates to prevent a similar accident from happening in the future. Mark Blake joins me now. Mark Blake, founder and director of Project Storm Drain Safety. Thank you for being with us, Mark.
Thank you for having me on. Really appreciate it.
I know it's a painful memory, but I also know it's important to understand how your son died in order to prevent similar accidents. Remind us, what happened to your son? What were the circumstances, please?
Logan was playing Frisbee on a playground at Arthur Elementary, where thousands of kids play all the time. This particular inlet was right by a jogging path, within feet of the jogging path. A Frisbee just went down into the brush right next to the inlet. He reached down to grab it. It had a really steep bank, and there was a lot of water running through it. He slipped. As soon as he hit the water, he disappeared. Mm-hmm. And that was the last anybody seen him alive.
Mm-hmm. And this is a large pipe, the diameter of which is several feet.
This one's 54 inches, but this has happened around the country to children as low as 12 inches pipes. Mm-hmm. The size just gets to be a little bit trickier to deal with, but smaller pipes are just as dangerous.
Mm-hmm. And a friend went in after him. The friend survived. We think that your son is hit his head, became unconscious, perhaps.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure that's what happened. That's my, I don't know if that's official. It was drowning either way. Mm-hmm. But Logan didn't take a beating like the guy that came out the other side. David was in pretty bad shape from fight, trying to stay up. Logan was much went through. With no struggle, he didn't have a lot of combative wounds or nothing on there, just a head. So we kind of came to the conclusion he hit his head pretty early, and that was it.
Tell me about the project that you've launched, a new not-for-profit organization, Project Storm Drain Safety. I guess start by telling us how common are similar accidents. You've researched this.
And a lot of information gets lost in just normal flood coverage. But we have stuff that you can find on the web clear back to 98, and it just continually happens. And on our site, we got a video that talks about all these instances. But one of the things in Denver, Colorado in 2000, they lost a firefighter who was trying to help somebody else in a flood, and a lot of people go that way, and I don't think they get reported quite as pinpointed as Logan's or some of the ones that we have on the list. I think it happens more than the people even understand.
Okay, so how do you fix a storm drain so that it's not the threat that it is?
You know, it's. I am not an engineer, but I happen to have met a bunch. It is a complex problem because if you change the inlet of a storm drain, you can cause a lot more problems than you're helping. So
you put a grate over it, then a bunch of sticks and things get caught in there, and you block it. Right,
there's a whole bunch of things that go along with it, and that's why when this all came about, there's a guy in Colorado, and his name is Ken McKenzie, and he AP calls him every time one of these happens. And I knew it would happen when this happened to me. I seen other parents getting called and interviewed, so I knew this would happen to me. They called me, and finally I called Ken McKenzie, and I'm like, we need to do something. He goes, I agree, and we went to work. But they have a lot of experience, and there's a lot of science in it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Make sure doesn't cause a worse problem.
Mm-hmm. We're running a little short of time, Mark Blake, but tell us, you've been to some of the pipes, the drains that have been fixed in Cedar Rapids. Are you happy? Have you been, for instance, out there when there's been a good rainfall to see what happens?
Yeah. I was there when the first rainfall, actually before they had a fence up, and it worked fantastic. It's at an angle where the debris lays on top and the water still runs underneath. It's really non-intrusive, and that's probably how a lot of them will go. The city went ahead on their own and targeted some other ones, and they're working on those right now. Our thing is there's millions of these, and let's see if we can help educate and get some more people.
Sounds like a wonderful project, Mark Blake. Before we say goodbye, tell us where can people go to find out more about Project Storm Drain Safety?
We are on Facebook on Project Storm Drain Safety, or you can go to projectstormdrainsafety.org. And there's a lot of information starting to come on that, and especially information on how you can help. Because we're brand new, and trust me, we need everything. So,
All right.
We could use some help, and that would be great.
Our thoughts are with you, and very sorry for the loss of your son, Logan. But I understand Logan was someone who understood the value of service and even thought he might go into the National Guard. So this would be a project he would be supporting.
He was about helping other people. And matter of fact, we had somebody come up to us on his birthday. We visited the site and put some memorials back up. And a lady stopped and said, the day that this happened, he stopped and helped us with a limb that was broken. You know, so it, right up to the end, he was about looking outside of himself to help somebody else.
Well,
and
we're glad you're doing the same, Mark Blake. Despite this loss, founder and executive director of Project Storm Drain Safety, lost your son a year ago, 17-year-old. Logan Blake dying after he was swept into a storm sewer in Cedar Rapids. Mark Blake, good luck with this project. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Now an update on a homicide case here in Iowa involving two college students from China. Last fall, the fall of 2014, Iowa State University student Tong Xiao was found dead in the trunk of a car in Iowa City. And by the time the body of the young woman had been discovered, Xiao's boyfriend, 23-year-old Sheng Nan Li, a former University of Iowa student, had already fled to China. This made him a suspect in the case. Earlier this month, Johnson County attorney Janet Linus and law enforcement officials turned over the evidence they had gathered in this murder to Chinese detectives, and this week the Iowa City Police Department announced that Li would face a charge of intentional homicide in his native China. Joining us to talk about some of the details here, Lee Hermiston has been covering this as a reporter for the Gazette. Hello, Lee.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. Did this come as a surprise this week, this announcement of a charge in his native China of intentional homicide?
Well, certainly for reporters, it came as a bit of a surprise. There was really no rumblings that this was coming, but as you had stated, local officials had been working with the Chinese government on this since the beginning of June, if not earlier.
Mm-hmm. What can you tell us? What do we know? Certainly the police know a lot more after you're looking at the evidence. What can you tell us about the relationship between Xiao and Li?
As far as we know, they were in some sort of romantic relationship. Authorities have referred to them as being in a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship. But Johnson County Attorney Janet Linus seemed to indicate that it was Xiao trying to end that relationship, which ultimately led to her death.
Mm-hmm. Xiao, the woman in this case, they're both in their early 20s?
Yes, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Johnson County attorney, Janet Linus, described handing the case over to the Chinese authorities as, I think you quoted in the article, very uncomfortable and very concerning. What do you think's behind that comment?
Well, I think there's a few things at play there. One, she had been working on this case for really about 10 months, and I think that police and prosecutors become very, you know, emotionally invested in cases like this. And their hope had always been that they would be the ones taking this case to trial. So when it became apparent that the only way that this was going to go to trial was in China, they had to somewhat reluctantly give that case over to, not only a different jurisdiction, but a different country with different customs, a different legal system. And after only meeting with them for a few days, take sort of a leap of faith that they would handle that case to the best of their ability and see that through.
Mm-hmm. So were there Chinese authorities who have been visiting Iowa about this case?
They visited for 3 or 4 days at the beginning of June. They met with the Iowa City Police Department and Johnson County Attorney Janet Linus. They went over the evidence. They went to some of the different crime scenes. They went to the DCI lab in Ankeny, I believe. And after about 3 or 4 days, the prosecution here and the police department handed over their evidence, which basically would make doing a trial here in the future, should things not work out in China, almost impossible because you create a lot of chain of custody issues there with the evidence.
Mm-hmm. Any sense of how the Chinese handled these sorts of investigations differently than authorities in the U.S., or is that that technique, that procedure, that method pretty much the same worldwide?
No, and my colleague Vanessa Miller had an article on that today looking at the different legal systems, and she didn't get into a lot of how their investigation unfolded, although Janet told both of us that they asked a lot of the same questions that prosecutors here would want to know about evidence, testimony, things of that nature. But China actually operates on a slightly different legal system where juries will hear a case, ask questions, and provide input, but the case is ultimately decided by not one, but three judges who will ultimately decide the outcome of the case.
Mm-hmm. This charge, intentional homicide, what is the penalty? He'll be tried in China. What is the penalty likely to be if found guilty?
Sure. The penalty, from our understanding, ranges anywhere from 10 years to life. And the indication seems to be that if a defendant cooperates, provides some sort of confession, that there is an expectation there of more leniency in the sentencing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and very quickly, no death penalty in China for this?
No, death penalty is absolutely on the table.
Is absolutely on the table.
Yes.
Okay. Lee Hermiston, I understand you'll be continuing to cover this story. Thank you very much for now.
Thank you, Ben.
Reporter for the Gazette, Lee Hermiston, updating us on a homicide case here in Iowa involving two college students from China.
And finally, on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio, the National Safety Council forecasts that over 400 Americans will be killed on the road during this long 4th of July weekend. Nearly 50,000 will be injured. Now, if the safety group's prediction proves accurate, that would make it the highest tally for a 4th of July holiday since 2008. Dan McGeehee is with us, Director of Human Factors and the Vehicle Safety Research Division at the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. Hi, Dan.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Why is this weekend in particular so dangerous on the road and predicted to be so deadly?
Well, there's a lot of different things going on this weekend, especially 4th of July. A lot more people are out on the road these days. And you take a look at fuel prices are near all-time lows. People are heading out to the lakes and out to camp. A lot more people on the road means a lot more crashes.
Mm-hmm. Other than some technical solutions, and we'll get to those in just a moment, is there anything we can do past mindful, defensive driving to prevent accidents?
Well, I think the main thing that's a little different about 4th of July than compared to others is there appears to be much more alcohol consumption out there as well, so that sort of exacerbates things. We also know that people are using their smartphones a lot more these days than they have in the past, and all those things sort of combine into a lot riskier driving. But really the main thing is that, safety belts, that's sort of trite to say, but it's the most important thing that we can wear, especially in the back seat. We're pretty good wearing seat belts in the front seat, but the back seat, not so much. So get everybody buckled up out there.
Mm-hmm. And of course, make sure that the children are in those safety seats.
Yes, It's 4'9" is the line. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has done a lot of crash testing, and 4'9", your kids need to be in a booster seat until that height.
Mm-hmm. And I understand during the summer months, speeding is especially a problem and very related to fatalities.
Yes, speed overall is a major issue in crashes. Obviously, the faster we go, the worse the kinds of injuries are out there, and especially in the rural states like Iowa, when we're primarily driving on rural two-lane roads, the speed can get out of control sometimes and we come across a curve. It's the most common crash type to be by yourself, just a single vehicle departing the road and, you know, hitting a culvert or a tree or something like that. That's a really common scenario.
Let's talk about some technology that is present now that wasn't in previous generations. What are you most excited about?
Well, one of the things that we've been studying at the University of Iowa now for about 20 years, we've been fortunate to be on the very first wave of these technologies going pretty far back. But I think the most exciting thing right now that we're seeing coming into vehicles is something called automatic braking systems. So this is where if you're distracted, your car will sense that there's some slow-moving vehicle ahead, and it will begin to brake automatically. And rear-end crashes are really one of the most common urban sort of stop-and-go kind of property damage crashes out there. So automatic braking is a really important one. We see lane departure systems where you begin to drift out of your lane, your car will correct that as well.
Mm-hmm. And systems for detecting if you're nodding off, you're sleepy too.
Yes, there are systems out there now that if your head begins to kind of bob down or your eyes begin to droop, they will detect that. And you'll get a little bit of a coffee cup icon will show up on some cars. So there's a lot of different technologies out there. And we've put together as part of a new national advertising campaign, education campaign around these technologies, a website called MyCarDoesWhat.org. And your listeners can go onto that website and read about all these really life-saving technologies that are entering the vehicles today.
Mm-hmm. I had the pleasure of being with you in an automated car last year, semi-automated, to test out some of the technologies you've just described there. How far have things in your lab evolved since only a year ago?
Well, I'm happy to report that we've just taken ownership of a advanced 2016 Volvo XC90, which is one of the first vehicles to be designed from the ground up as an automated car. This particular vehicle is going to be used in Gothenburg, Sweden next year for a 100 automated car test called Drive Me. And we have a version of that vehicle that just arrived last Friday in Iowa City. And you'll be seeing that running around the streets of Iowa soon.
Okay. And the advances it makes over the previous generation?
This one essentially will go from stop. It's called stop and go adaptive cruise control. And so, for instance, the other day we were able to drive from Iowa City out to Kelowna essentially with lane tracking and motion all automatic. It will come to a complete stop, and then when the car ahead starts moving, it will begin to advance by itself.
Hmm. All right. Thanks for the update. Dan McGeehee, Director of Human Factors and the Vehicle Safety Research Division at the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. And again, the website to find out some fascinating things that are coming into vehicle technology to make them safer. MyCarDoesWhat.org. Check it out. Dan McGeehee. Have a great and safe Independence Day weekend.
You too, Ben. Thanks so much.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. If you want to hear a podcast of this program or any of our other prior talk shows, go to iowapublicradio.org. You'll find podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River and Talk of Iowa. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime. Here's our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.